Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. Today, we're going to talk about a superfruit that can significantly clean your arteries. Also, for those of you who have enlarged prostates, prostate cancer, or want to help yourself, I'm going to give you a more in-depth understanding of what you can do through your diet to help keep your prostate healthy. And this will be very comprehensive. I suggest you get a pencil and paper. Then an original, in-depth investigative report. The new flu season, a pain, profit, and politics. This is going to be posted later on the Progressive Radio Network, and it is fully referenced with dozens of scientific studies posted at the end. This will give those who believe that, well, get a flu vaccine and be protected from the flu, it'll give you a moment to pause. Then, if time permits, from our environmental segment, we're going to take a look at what is the price that we pay for our pollution worldwide. This polluter won't pay anything. That's the United States. It literally shirks its climate justice responsibilities. Fears confirmed offshore fracking is a toxic mess. The Center for Biological Diversity analysis reveals a list of toxic chemicals in offshore fracking, often dumped with wastewater into the ocean, by Jacob Chamberlain, staff writer for Common Dreams. And again, if time permits, a commentary from Professor Paul Craig Roberts. What is the real agenda of the American police state? This is a part of our continuing series on fascism in America. Let's begin. Most Americans by the age of 18 already have signs of clogging of the arteries. In fact, there was a famous study. We had Professor Colin Campbell, the China study, who was talking about this in a recent documentary. And in this documentary, he stated that when they looked at autopsies of Vietnamese soldiers, they had 1% or less of clogging of the arteries or heart disease. American soldiers who had died in combat had upwards of 50 to 70% clogging of the arteries. That meant that they were candidates for heart attacks and strokes and various forms of heart disease. Mind you, they were probably 19 years old. Today, when you look at the American diet, it is a mess. Even for those people who are what I call token healthy eaters, they will, on occasion, have something healthy. But more often than not, they don't. And you can really undermine really quickly anything you've done right by doing something wrong. So we end up with clogged arteries. So what are we to do? Look for bits and pieces, one piece at a time. And one of the easiest things you can do is to consume pomegranate juice, to eat pomegranates, which are readily available. They last about a week in a refrigerator. They last indefinitely if they're frozen. So when I find them in large containers, I'll buy 5 or 6 of them, put them into a bag, press out the air, freeze it, then it stays good as long as you need it to be there. Why the pomegranate? Because the pomegranate is a superfood. It's a superfruit. And it is one of the most researched fruits in all of nature. And the research actually shows, according to the peer-reviewed journal Atherosclerosis, quote, pomegranate extract reduce aortic stenosis and coronary artery atherosclerosis in SR mice, Anthroprotective effects of pomegranate extract appear to involve reduced oxidative stress and inflammation in the vessel wall despite unaltered systemic markers of inflammation, increased lipoprotein cholesterol in these mice, end quote. In lay language, this is what it meant. In this study where mice were given pomegranate extracts, it reduced the fat accumulation in the heart itself. That saves your heart. It reduced enlargement of the heart. That saves your heart. It improved ECG results, it reduced oxidative stress, and reduced levels of proteins and chemicals found in heart disease and inflammation. Now, another study looked at humans with atherosclerosis and measured their arteries at the onset in 1 year after beginning pomegranate juice. And in 1 year's time, the participants, quote, reduce plaque in their carotid arteries, that's the artery leading to your brain, by up to 30%. That's terrific. Now, we know pomegranates are a valuable source of antioxidants, including vitamin C, but it's something else in there that is anti-inflammatory. They can really turn off inflammation. They can loosen up hardening of the arteries. They can chelate and free your arteries from this plaque buildup. So here's my suggestion. Consume pomegranates, one 12-ounce glass of pomegranate to 16-ounce glass of pomegranate juice unsweetened per day. If you have heart disease, if you have blocked arteries, if you have atherosclerosis, then I'm going to go more concentrated. Start off with like 6 ounces, which is a very small amount, of juice, the unsweetened juice, and then add 3 ounces of pomegranate concentrate, and then 2 tablespoons of concentrated powder. And that gives you a super boost. So that's what I would start with. Mind you, there are many things that can help you unclog your arteries and make your arteries soft and pliable, rather than rigid and calcified and stiff. And pomegranates are one, but it's an easy one, and they're not expensive. Now to the topic that I got a lot of response from. Men and women wanting to know what to do to help a man's prostate. Men are not very compliant about getting their prostate tested and getting blood work up to show whether or not they have an elevated PSA, which is a marker to tell you whether or not your prostate is healthy or under siege. It's pretty easy to determine the state of your health of your prostate. And now you go on from inflamed prostate to enlarged prostate to prostate cancer. And study after study, including the American Society of Clinical Oncology, found that food in concentrated pills had a dramatic impact on men with prostate cancer. And this was presented at the American Society of Clinical Oncology's annual meeting, where the world's leading experts on cancer get together, and they found that there were 4 specific polyphenol-rich foods that are known to have anti-cancer properties. And this was provided under the National Cancer Research Network. So it had high scientific credibility and quality assurance. So what are the 4 foods that were the most beneficial that actually had rigorous trials, double-blind placebo-controlled trials, randomized, to show that you could lower your prostate-specific antigen, or PSA? And what they found was that you could radically lower your PSA, protect your prostate, and help you live a longer life, even if you had prostate cancer, with 4. Once again, we have pomegranate. Pomegranate seed, that the seed in the pomegranate, it's the little fleshy orb. It should be pink or red. We find that they're more red when they come from Argentina and Chile. They're more pink when they come from the United States. It's probably the variety of the pomegranate. I grow pomegranate trees, and I can get anywhere from a pink to a very red, depending upon the fertilizer I'm using. But in any case, either one's fine. And then we have green tea, turmeric, and broccoli. Those are the 4 superstars that can make an enormous difference. Now, here's the logic of it. If you have an enlarged prostate or prostate cancer, then what you would do could also help prevent an enlarged prostate or prostate cancer. So this should be taken preventatively by all men. Pomegranate compounds suppress enzymes in the intestine and liver that convert certain molecules, what are called procarcinogens, into cancer-causing agents. They prevent that. And according to Life Extension, as it relates to those with prostate cancer, the active constituents in pomegranate have been proven as potent inducers of a malignant cell death. This is called apoptosis, meaning a cancer cell commits suicide. It dies. This is so important because this is the least toxic, most beneficial way of killing cancer cells, but not harming, as chemotherapy does, all other cells. Remember, with chemotherapy, you can certainly kill some cancer cells, yes, but you're going to kill 1,000 healthy cells for every cancer cell you kill. So it's rather foolish. So their idea is, let's hopefully kill the cancer cells before we kill the patient. But last year, 500,000 people died before their cancer cells were killed because they had so many healthy cells killed. So this apoptosis is from pomegranates, and that's important. Now, during the development of androgen independence, prostate cancer cells are known to increase testosterone synthesis inside their own cells, which maintains cancer cell growth in the absence of significant amounts of circulating testosterone. So when you have an overexpression, too much of the androgen receptors occurs in androgen-independent prostate cancer and has been proposed as another mechanism promoting the development of androgen independence. So prostate interferes in that whole process. And again, that's good. So that's one thing we need to do. Now, another is green tea. If you examine the scientific literature of over 5,000 studies in the peer-reviewed literature on green tea, you'll see that it is so important in preventing defects from radiation. And we believe that one of the reasons more people did not die of radiation poisoning from the two bombs that were dropped in Japan is because at that time they were a devastated country. They were starving, but they didn't have a shortage of tea, and the tea they drank is historically the green tea. And green tea has some very strong protective properties. Specifically, these are polyphenols called catechins. And these catechins, C-A-T-E-C-H-I-N, they're named EGCG, and they accumulate specifically in prostate tissue, where they selectively kill cancer cells, but they leave healthy cells unaffected, and that reduces PSA levels. In a further demonstration of the cancer-suppressing role of green tea, when researchers studied men with a precancerous condition called prostate intraepithelial neoplasia, they found only one tumor after 1 year in 30 men given green tea polyphenols, while the 30 placebo recipients developed 9 cancers. So the treatment was safe, and an extra bonus was found to reduce other lower urinary tract symptoms as well. So I would suggest that when you look at the figures and see, they're remarkable. Cancer prevention in Japan is tremendous because studies documented prostate cancer risk reduced by up to 86% in men who drank the most green tea. How much would I drink if I were doing it preventatively? 3 to 4 glasses a day. And by the way, there are many different ways of having green tea. You could brew your green tea. Let's say it's a Sunday afternoon, and you take an hour, and you brew up 2 gallons of green tea. And then you put that in a fridge, and you put some lemon in it. Generally, for every gallon of any juice, you put the juice of 2 lemons and 1 teaspoon of vitamin C in it. That'll preserve it. Then, throughout the day, you can have a cold green tea after a hot workout. You can have green tea before you go out for a workout. You can have it with a meal. So there are many different ways of getting into your body. Now, let's say that you just can't drink it. Fine. Then take 200 milligrams 4 to 5 times a day, up to about 1,000 milligrams, to get what they have been using in the Orient as a prophylactic to protect yourself from cancer and to protect your prostate. Then we have that kind of orange-yellow herb that is so common in Indian cuisine, turmeric. Turmeric is unique in that it can help the prostate cancer fighting and anti-inflammatory properties inside the body. And that's because of one ingredient called curcumin. Cure, C-U-R, cumin, C-U-M-I-N. It reduces inflammation, and that helps reduce metastasis that ultimately kill prostate cancer patients. So curcumin also down-regulates genes involved in adhesion and motility and invasiveness that prostate cancer cells need to invade and spread. So if you want to keep the cancer localized to the prostate, which increases your risk of surviving, you don't want it to spread to other organs, then curcumin can help do that. Also, curcumin by itself inhibits prostate cancer cell production of PSA by blocking its genetic expression. And at the same time, it also reduces activation of the androgen receptors on cancer cells that trigger increased production of PSA. But the whole turmeric root also contains important oils and other substances that enhance curcumin's absorption and have health benefits of their own. I'm just telling you about cancer now. There are a dozen other conditions that curcumin helps with. Then we have broccoli. Now, broccoli, you've heard me discuss many times on this program, eating broccoli, juicing broccoli, having broccoli sprouts. They're all good because of a couple of nutrients. One is called sulforaphane and indole-3-carbinol, or for short, I3C. And these are potent epigenetic regulators. And also the broccoli compound control enzymes called histone acetylases, which regulate the genes encoded in DNA, including those responsible for promoting or suppressing cancer formation. And they're known collectively as histone deacetylates, or inhibitors, and they help stop the cancer. The bottom line to broccoli is that when you're consuming cruciferous vegetables, all cruciferous vegetables, you could have a 40% lower risk of invasive prostate cancer. And in animal studies, broccoli feeding reduced prostate tumor weight by 42% in prostate cancer-prone mice and suppressed cancer growth by implanting human prostate cancer cells. So it's powerful. So you got to have your broccoli. All right, so green tea, turmeric, broccoli, and pomegranate. That is what can help you if you have prostate enlargement, prostate inflammation, cancer of the prostate. I'm Gary Knoll, here to talk about the things that can allow us to live a longer and healthier life. Back in a moment with a special, in-depth, original investigative report. A new flu season of pain, profit, and politics. Have you with us, everyone. A few program announcements before we go to our original in-depth investigative report. And I will be posting this a little later on today on my website and Facebook page, and hopefully you will read it before you get a flu vaccine. Whether someone vaccinates themselves or not is your right, your freedom of choice. I don't interfere in that process. I just want you to know the full story and have real information, not pseudoscience. Also, I'm going to be hiring a person that is very proficient at translating Spanish, English into Spanish, for a new book of mine. It's a paid position, so if you are a person who has the ability to translate English into Spanish and correctly, then there's a possibility of a job for you. You'll call Jeremy at 646-926-5434, because all my new books are also going to have Spanish editions. 646-926-5434, and I've got 6 new books coming out. I'm putting them 1 every 4 months. Also, I'm sorry, but the premiere is sold out, or not premiere, but my lecture tonight is sold out, tomorrow sold out. I'm sorry. No more room. And the first mention of my new Silent Epidemic, The Untold Story of Vaccines, was sold out. Then they increased the size of the theater to another, and it sold out. And now they've put me into the largest theater they have at the Cinema Arts Center on Sunday at noon. That's noon, 12 o'clock. And I don't know how many seats they have available, but I'm looking forward to being there, to having a lecture, having you see this. I'm going to give you some free copies of the film as well. The Silent Epidemic, you won't want to miss it. It's powerful. The number to call for reservations is 631-423-7611. 631-423-7611. I will be there, and I'm hopeful that you will. Also, we are interviewing now for people to do some new shows, a senior citizen, or Getting Old in America radio program once a week, a gardening show once a week, and a college show, meaning answering the questions that every college kid has about everything in their life. If you feel qualified to do a show and would like to try out, and you can call 646-926-5422. Those are program announcements. Now, next week, following almost 9 months of in-depth investigative reporting by our scholars and residents and myself, we believe that we can now prove who killed JFK. We can prove the 3 shooters, the people behind it, and we will be selecting the six individuals who are going to share insights that we have independently verified. You have not heard these people. You didn't even know any of this stuff. And we're not letting anything out until the actual shows. I realize that some of our sister stations will be being preempted because of some fundraising for the National Archive, and that's understandable, not a problem. But we're going to be doing it live every day at noon, and if you can't hear it because of preemptions, you can always listen over the Internet at ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com or over the telephone at 619-550-0869, 619-550-0869. It starts Monday at noon, then Monday evening at 7, then Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday at noon. You should tell some people they have not heard this information before. We reviewed hundreds upon hundreds of people who thought they had answers. We found too many discrepancies, the ones that we're sharing with you each day, and it's only one person per show. So it's going to be really powerful. But this is going to be a new history lesson. So when I'm listening to some of the other programs talk, you know, with Oliver Stone, and they tell us nothing. Or where were you at? It's irrelevant where you were at. What's relevant is who killed him. That's what's relevant. Not where you were at or what you were doing, what you were eating. I don't care if you're having a sandwich. Who killed the president and how'd they get away with it? It would have had to been someone very powerful. Unless those who were very powerful were complicit. So we're going to lay out an argument of who killed Kennedy starting Monday, live every day at noon, except on Monday where it's my evening show is also a progressive commentary. I was going to have it as well. So 6 hours next week. Hope that you can listen. Now let's go to our issue of the day. This is an original in-depth investigative report entitled The New Flu Season of Pain, Profit, and Politics by Richard Gale and myself. According to all official health reports, we are now fully in flu season. It is that time of year when public health officials and physicians, pediatricians, and pharmacists warn that everyone over 6 months of age should protect themselves and get vaccinated. Most Americans believing the government's propaganda about safety and benefits of the flu vaccine are joining the inoculation lines without pausing to consider the accuracy and legitimacy of health officials and pediatrician claims. The official government figure for the annual number of deaths caused by influenza remains at 36,000 dead. Why this figure has not changed during the course of a decade is anyone's guess. However, there can be between 150 to 200 different infectious pathogens you have adenovirus, rhinovirus, parainfluenza virus, the very common coronavirus, and of course pneumonia that produce flu-like symptoms. For example, how many people have heard of Boca virus, which is responsible for bronchitis, pneumonia in young children, or a Metapan virus, responsible for a form of pneumonia, all flu-like related symptoms. This is true during every flu season, and it'll be no different this year. If you take the combined figure of flu and pneumonia deaths for the period of 2001 and add a bit of spin to the figures, we're left believing that 62,034 people have died from influenza. The actual figures determined by Dr. Peter Doshi, then at Harvard University, are 61,777 died from pneumonia, and only 257 died from flu. Even more amazing, among those 257 cases who died from flu, only 18 were confirmed positive for influenza. A CBS investigative report published October 2012 exemplifies the unreliable and perhaps intentionally deceptive misinformation campaign steered by the U.S. government and its health agencies every flu season. So after the CDC refused to honor CBS's Freedom of Information Act request to receive flu infection data by individual state, the network undertook an independent investigation across all 50 states to get their infectious disease statistics. The final report contradicts in the extreme, dramatically, the CDC's public relations blitz. For example, in California, among the approximately 13,000 flu-like cases, 86% tested negative for any flu strain. In Florida, of 8,853 cases, 83% were negative of any flu. In Georgia and Alaska, only 2.1% in Georgia and only 1%, that's 1%, respectively tested positive for flu virus among all reported flu-like cases. If the infection rate ratios obtained by CBS are accurate, the CDC's figures are significantly reduced and flu season severity is overstated dramatically. In addition to false advertising by the government and American media, over recent years, we have witnessed an increase in the so-called scientific studies framed as commercials and public relations spin to promote vaccine efficacy. A highly flawed medical trial conducted by a vaccine maker has a greater chance of being published in a prestigious medical journal than scientifically sound, honest research conducted by an independent scientist or university without conflict of interest than would be by the government or private industries. When we question why this is the case, the deduction is that such research is more often than not promotional spin to support the financial interests of corporate parties. This is particularly true of industry and government-funded vaccine trials with the sole intention of influencing the nation's health policy makers and physicians and to relieve doubts concerning vaccine efficacy and safety. The nation's health agencies then rely upon these fabrications to convince the healthcare community and citizens about the importance of vaccination and the dangers of contracting an infectious disease. And this scenario is particularly flagrant in studies promoting flu vaccine propaganda. There is a single question that needs to be answered. What is the actual gold standard proof to claim that the flu vaccine is efficacious for any given individual? The question whether or not the flu vaccine is safe becomes secondary if the vaccine's efficacy is negligible or useless. In that case, there'd be no convincing scientific rationale for administering the vaccine in the first place. And during the past 4 years, since the hype of the subsequent enthusiasm around the 2008 H1N1 scare, we have done an extensive review of the scientific literature and analysis of flu vaccinations, and the results are startling. In an interview that I did with Dr. Thomas Jefferson, coordinator of the Cochrane vaccine field in Rome, Italy, He stated that in 2009 he conducted a thorough review of 217 published studies on flu vaccines and found only 5% of 217 were reliable. In other words, 95% of all studies published on vaccines that he reviewed were grossly flawed and their conclusions should be dismissed. Now, this is not a great surprise. Even CDC officials were forced to confess that, quote, influenza vaccines are still among the least effective immunizing agents available, and this seems to be particularly true for elderly recipients, end quote. That's from the CDC. Dr. Anthony Morris, a distinguished virologist and a former chief vaccine officer at the FDA, found, quote, there is no evidence that any influenza vaccine thus far developed is effective in preventing or mitigating an attack of influenza, end quote. The producers of these vaccines know they are worthless, but they go on selling them anyway, end quote. Let me repeat this, because this is an outstanding scientist in the field at the FDA. Quote, there is no evidence that any influenza vaccine thus far developed is effective in preventing or mitigating any attack by influenza. In 2006, Dr. Peter Doshi published a devastating study in the British Medical Journal that systematically unveils the flawed predictive science used to publicize our health agency's influenza statistics and mortality rates. His analysis shook up enough health authorities to warrant 12 scientists from the CDC and the National Institutes of Health to unsuccessfully challenge him. Now at Johns Hopkins, Doshi continues his analysis of a century's worth of influenza mortality statistics and government manipulation of influenza data, such as the annual figure of 36,000 influenza deaths we hear and read repeatedly. And although this magical number was, for all the practical purposes, alchemy, conjured via mathematical modeling back in 2003, it continues to be the most holy number in the CDC's public relations vocabulary every flu season. Doshi draws a conclusion published in the American Journal of Public Health. The commercial interests are playing the role of science in both industry and government. When we review the FDA and CDC's flawed methodology for promulgating the myth that 36,000 Americans die annually from flu infections, we will see that over 90% of these mortalities are a result of pneumonia and other infections, not the influenza virus. In fact, on the CDC's own website, the agency makes reference to the deaths caused by influenza and pneumonia and that they are grouped together. In a more recent 2013 report published in the British Medical Journal, Dr. Doshi had this to say about the flu vaccinations, quote, the vaccine may be less beneficial and less safe than has been claimed, and the threat of influenza seems to be overstated, end quote. He notes that a study published by an Australian team found, quote, one in every 110 children under the age of five had convulsions following vaccinations in 2009 of H1N1 influenza vaccine. Separate independent studies conducted in UK, Finland, and Sweden concur that the flu vaccine directly contributed to the rise in cases of narcolepsy following receipt of the GlaxoSmithKline the Pandemrix vaccine. The conclusion is that the vaccine triggered an immune reaction against the children's sleep center cells. Perhaps the vaccine industry's single most vital error to determine whether flu vaccines are effective lies in its unsound belief that measuring antibodies following vaccination is indicative of protection from the flu vaccine, flu infection. Therefore, studies are strictly designed to quantify antibody levels and not to discover whether the vaccine actually prevents disease. Now, what does that mean in lay language? It means this. Let's say that you get a flu vaccine and they take a blood sample and they find that you've had an elevation in some antibodies. That in itself doesn't mean anything. That just means your body's reacting to a foreign antigen. But does that prove that it will protect you? No, there is no such thing. Well, then what is the purpose? It's pure theater. This primitive and biologic-denying creed is a major reason why more voices in the scientific community acknowledge that the entire premise of the flu vaccine is based upon junk science. As a result, one of the very few double-blind placebo-controlled trials on Sanofi Pasteur's Vaxagrip influenza vaccine utilizing a genuine placebo, meaning a saline solution, noted, quote, a 550% higher rate in respiratory infections caused by the non-influenza viruses in the vaccinated group compared to the unvaccinated. So why didn't we know that there was a 550% increase in those who got the flu vaccine? Well, because that would have caused people to think twice about getting the vaccine. The CDC's website states, quote, if you're pregnant, a flu shot is your best protection against serious illness from the flu. A flu shot can protect women who are pregnant, their unborn babies, and even the baby after birth, end quote. But that's not true. Is there any scientific truth to that claim? We would expect that if there were, then we would find this mention on the flu vaccine package insert. But we don't. For example, for the H1N1 vaccine inserts, quote, it is not known whether these vaccines can cause fetal harm when administered to pregnant women or can affect reproduction capacity, end quote. That was on the package insert. Then why are women who are pregnant being given this? Surprisingly, few vaccine studies have been performed on pregnant women, and none of them, according to Dr. Jefferson, are, quote, high quality. And while some extremely poor trials have been conducted, the CDC's National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease research into the potential dangers and risk of the flu vaccine to both moms and the fetus is negligible. After evaluating all flu vaccine studies on pregnant women and finding them, quote, artificial in the way they were designed and carried out, Dr. Jefferson concluded, quote, I would be very, very cautious about vaccinating unborn babies. The New York Times published an article touting the CDC's myth of flu vaccine safety for pregnant women. The Times quoted Dr. Jay Butler, the CDC's chief of swine flu vaccine task force, to relieve fears about flu vaccine adverse effects, especially to pregnant women. Dr. Butler said, quote, there are about 2,400 miscarriages a day in the United States. You'll see things that would happen anyway. But the vaccine doesn't cause miscarriages. It doesn't cause auto accidents, but they happen, end quote. Not very reassuring to expectant mothers across the country, especially since none of the approved H1N1 vaccines used at the time had undergone rigorous clinical safety trials on pregnant women or the potential adverse effects of mercury-laced vaccines and other ingredients such as spermicides, detergents, and cosmetics on the developing fetus. In 2012, the National Coalition of Organized Women received documents with statistics based upon the government's Vaccine Awareness Events Reporting System, covering 2009 and 10 flu season. The CDC's own vaccine injury data collection revealed, listen carefully, a 4,250% increase in fetal deaths after the flu shot. This is the government's own reporting system, Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. Statistics were confirmed later by Dr. Gary Goldman and published in the peer-reviewed Human and Environmental Toxicology Journal, showing that the H1N1 swine flu vaccine did in fact cause a 4,250% rise in spontaneous abortions. The question is, did anyone at the New York Times at all feel any compunction to correct their promotion of the vaccine, or did the person from the CDC? The answer is no. The CDC has refused to provide further information under a Freedom of Information Act filing until after a three-year period, a direct violation of the act in the law. When confronted and queried about the rise in fetal deaths among vaccinated pregnant women, the CDC's doctor in charge, Dr. Shimbruku, confirmed the agency knew of this increase. They knew it, they covered it up, and then they went ahead killing babies. A study appearing in the journal Vaccine provides a strong warning against administering the flu vaccine to pregnant women. The study observed a rise in inflammation in pregnant women that relates directly to preeclampsia and leading to premature births. Commenting upon the study, Sarah G., founder of GreenMed Info, wrote this should be expected given the, quote, highly inflammatory, neurotoxic, and immunotoxic ingredients list in flu vaccines. Do you know what's in your flu vaccine? Let me share. These are the actual ingredients. Ethyl mercury, thimerosal, powerful neurotoxin in any amount, implicated in autism, seizures, mental retardation, and dyslexia. Aluminum compounds, unknown and proven neurotoxin that has been associated with brain damage, dementia, Alzheimer's, and compulsions. Ammonium sulfate, commonly used in pesticide preparations and attributed to respiratory toxicity. Another hazardous chemical associated with lymphomas in animals. Formaldehyde. Now there's something, that's embalming fluid. And it's also known to be a carcinogen, neurotoxin, and genetic disruptor. Monosodium glutamate, MSG. And it'll affect your behavior and reproduction. What is called oxytocinol 9, a vaginal spermicide. Phenol, an immune inhibitor that has been known to be highly toxic to the cardiovascular nervous system, reproductive and respiratory systems, and once employed by the Nazis in the concentration camps. Polysorbate 80, associated with anaphylactic shock and a classified carcinogen in animals. That is what's in your flu vaccine, and that most people have no idea of. If the dangers of the toxic chemical ingredients found in flu vaccines is not enough, there's also the high health risk associated with the cellular medium pharmaceutical companies use to prepare the influenza virus. Commonly, chicken embryos have been the standard medium for growing flu strains. In her book, Fear of the Invisible, medical investigative journalist Janine Roberts reproduced documents from closed CDC meetings to discuss problems associated with vaccine manufacturing. The meeting was called to raise alarm and review the degree of genetic contamination found in vaccine preparations that rely upon chicken embryo and other animal tissue medium, including the flu vaccine. The transcripts concluded that due to the primitive methodology to filtrate vaccine preparations, the end result injected into people could contain numerous known and unknown genetic and protein residues and contaminants. During one meeting, Dr. Andrew Lewis, then head of the DNA Virus Laboratory in the Division of Viral Products, confirmed, quote, all the egg-based vaccines are contaminated. Let me repeat that. All the egg-based vaccines are contaminated. These fertilized chicken eggs are susceptible to a wide variety of viruses, end quote. Now, among these viruses are avian leucosis virus associated with leukemia, cancer, and birds, and equine virus associated with arthritic conditions in horses. Dr. Conroy, the World Health Organization, stated that the arthritis virus is found in all fertilized chicken eggs. Other active biological ingredients include prions, tiny proteins responsible for incurable diseases, neurological diseases in both humans and animals, oncogenes, the gene that turns normal cells cancerous. One attendee, a Dr. Goldberg, stated, quote, there are countless thousands of undiscovered viruses, proteins, and similar particles. We have only identified a very small part of the microbial world, and we can only test for those we have identified. Thus, the vaccine cultures could contain many unknown particles, end quote. Because of the known dangers and high level of genetic contamination of all flu vaccines developed from chicken embryos, other mediums are being sought to replace them. Novartis's Flucelvax employs dog kidney cells. In a more recent flu vaccine approved by the FDA this year, it utilizes a cell line from the armyworm, but no known research has been conducted to our knowledge on the risks of the body's immune system from these new genetic cell lines. When the CDC launched the new swine flu vaccine in 2009, it recommended vaccination of children as young as 6 months. All FDA-approved intramuscular flu vaccines comprise an inactivated virus. So is there any evidence that inactivated viral influenza vaccines are effective in very young children? Our own analysis and review has not uncovered any convincing scientific evidence. However, some of the most damning evidence was reported in two studies performed by Dr. Tom Jefferson at the Cochrane Group and published in the British medical journal The Lancet and the prestigious Cochrane Database Systems Review. The first study was a systematic review of the effects of influenza vaccine in healthy children. The second was a review of every single available published and unpublished safety evidence study available regarding the flu vaccine. The authors of the study had also contacted the lead scientists or research groups for all the efficacy and safety trials under review in order to gain access to additional unpublished data the corporations may possess. The conclusions are shocking. The only safety study found for an inactivated flu vaccine was conducted in 1976, and that single study enrolled 35 children ages 12 to 28 months. Every other subsequent inactivated flu vaccine enrolled only three years and older. Therefore, upon what medical basis should the flu vaccine be administered to six-month-old children? There is none. Zero. Not a scintilla. In a review of 51 different studies involving 294,000 children, there was, quote, no evidence that injecting children 6 to 24 months of age with a flu shot was any more effective than a placebo. In children over 2 years of age, flu vaccine effectiveness was 33% of the time preventing flu. Dr. Jefferson told Reuters, quote, immunization of very young children is not lent support by our findings. We recorded no convincing evidence that vaccines can reduce death, hospital admissions, serious complications, and community transmission of influenza. In young children now below the age of two, we could find no evidence that the vaccine was different from a placebo. End quote. A live flu virus vaccine is available via nasal administration. As for this vaccine, no safety studies have been performed on children under 22 months. Of course, a vaccine with a flu-active virus can make the recipient potentially contagious. National Vaccine Information Prevention founder and president Barbara Lou Fisher concurs, quote, the live virus-activated vaccine has the ability to spread the flu, end quote. MedImmune, the sole manufacturer of the live flu nasal vaccine, repeatedly refused to give unpublished data to Dr. Jefferson without executive clearance. This was also true for some vaccine makers working with inactive viruses. Then we come to mercury. Mercury in the form of thimerosal. It continues to be used in infant influenza vaccines. An important peer-reviewed study, appearing in the June 2009 issue of Toxicological and Environmental Chemistry, discovered a causal relationship between the amount of mercury found in infant flu vaccines when administered to monkeys and cellular toxicity resulting in mitochondrial dysfunction, impaired oxidative reduction activity, and degradation and death in neuronal and fetal cells. These are all indicative signs found in autism spectrum disorder. But health officials prefer to ignore such results. For the future health of American children, the study's findings arrived at a bad time when a Harvard study reported that autistic spectrum disorder had increased to 1 in 91 people compared to earlier 1 in 150. Now let's go to the senior citizens. Is there any benefit for a senior citizen to receive the flu vaccine? To date, there is in fact no, I repeat, no credible data to support the marketing campaign to push flu vaccination upon the elder population. Rather, there is strong scientific data to suggest that seniors avoid it at all cost. For the 2013 flu season, Fluzone is the preferred vaccine being marketed to seniors. This so-called high-dose vaccine contains more viral antigens compared to the normal vaccine given to younger adults. These results of Fluzone's own safety trials documented a 7.1% of elderly volunteers experienced serious adverse events. 23 people in the trial died. I repeat, 23 people in the trial died following administration of the vaccine. All told, 249 serious adverse events out of 3,833 participants enrolled in the study. A common excuse we hear from the CDC and the FDA when a vaccine has been associated with serious health consequences is that the problem is not the vaccine, but other unidentifiable health risks of the victim. This type of defense and blatant denial is found repeatedly on all federal health agencies' own websites. In 64 different studies that looked at a total of 66,000 healthy adults, quote, vaccination of healthy adults only reduced risk of influenza by 6% and reduced the number of missed days of work by less than one. There was no change in the number of hospitalizations compared to the non-vaccinated, end quote. So if this is true of healthy adults, what about flu vaccine's efficacy among the elderly who are frequently immunocompromised from other illnesses? The flu vaccine has been shown to be less effective among seniors over 65 years of age than other age groups. Nevertheless, the over 65 population remains a primary target for the federal vaccine campaigns. There have been many studies conducted in nursing homes to determine how effective flu vaccines are in preventing infection. Average effectiveness results, which means measuring only the dose required to stimulate an adequate immune response, are in the low to mid 20%. Another set of four studies indicates flu vaccine was only 0 or 2 or 8 or 9% effective in four different studies. Yet despite these dismal results, the CDC still wishes us to believe that vaccinating elderly citizens is 50 to 60% effective in preventing hospitalizations of pneumonia and 80% effective in preventing deaths. That's not true. They have zero evidence on their side. They are lying. Government health projections confirm, and the CDC has been forced to acknowledge, that elderly people with or without the flu shot show less than 1% rate of being hospitalized for pneumonia or influenza. That means that 99% of elderly people manage to weather the storm. In an even more shocking study, the CDC had to admit that last year's flu vaccine was 91% ineffective for senior citizens. However, this has not discouraged the government officials from marketing the flu vaccine upon senior citizens and professional geriatric medical associations and healthcare facilities. An important Dutch study was conducted in a large home for the elderly. In spite of two-thirds of the residents having been vaccinated, the flu infected 49% of them, including bacterial and pneumonial infections, and 10% died. The critical observation found in the study was that 50% of those vaccinated got the disease, whereas only 48% of the non-vaccinated were infected. The results of the study again reveal the uselessness of the flu vaccine. Heart and cardiovascular disease risks increase during natural aging and is a leading cause of death among the elderly. It has recently been discovered in a study published in the International Journal of Medicine that the flu vaccine contributes to cardiovascular inflammation, thereby increasing the risk of heart attack. The study found that the flu vaccine induced platelet activity, elevated C-reactive protein, and reduced heart rate variability, all indicative of cardiovascular events. Alzheimer's disease is now the sixth leading cause of death in the United States and affects over 5 million people. The disease is growing rapidly, and today, 1 in 3 seniors die from it or another form of dementia at a cost of $200 billion this year alone. And it's going to increase in the near future over $1 trillion. Well, then they're told we'll get a vaccine. Where's there any evidence? There's only evidence that it may have contributed to Alzheimer's. Dr. Hugh Funderburg, a leading immunologist and founding director of Neuroimmunotherapeutic Research Foundation, is one of the most quoted immunogeneticists of our times, with over 850 papers in the peer-reviewed publications. For years of immunological studies, he discovered that individuals who had 5 consecutive flu shots between 1970 and 1980, the chances of acquiring Alzheimer's disease was 1,000% higher than those who had only 1 or 2 vaccinations during the same time period. The reasoning is the accumulate amount of mercury and aluminum in the body after successive annual flu shots. Vaccine opponents claim that one of the adverse effects of vaccination is the onset of asthmatic conditions. A great way to counter this attack is to make the claim that flu vaccination will reduce asthmatic attacks brought on by flu infections among those children who are most susceptible to them. In fact, this is what the vaccine industry claims. A study by Dr. Herman Boving at the Department of Family Practice at Erasmus Medical University in Rotterdam, Netherlands, conducted one of the few randomized double-blind placebo-controlled studies found in vaccine literature. The 2-year study enrolling 696 asthmatic children, half vaccinated, the other half with a placebo. The study found there was no difference between incidence and severity of asthmatic attacks between the two groups. This study exposes another CDC deception and strengthened the case against flu vaccine's ineffectiveness. In fact, in children with asthma, inactivated flu vaccine did not prevent influenza-related hospitalizations in children. The database shows that children who received the flu vaccine were at a higher risk of hospitalization than children who did not receive the vaccine. In a separate study involving 400 children with asthma receiving the flu vaccine and 400 who were not immunized, there was no difference in the number of clinic and emergency room visits and hospitalizations between the two groups. Now, that brings us up to the end of this program. It does not bring us up to the end of the scientific paper. And I still have not reviewed the total safety and efficacy, but that will all be in the article that we publish later today on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com or Gary Knoll's Facebook page for you to use. About once a month, we will be doing a new original in-depth investigative report, and every week we'll continue to do original and in-depth commentaries. I thank you for taking your time to listen, and remember, every day next week and twice on Monday at noon and at 7, you'll hear the most comprehensive investigation on who killed President John F. Kennedy 50 years ago that you have seen, heard at any time in the last 50 years. You will not want to miss it. Have a nice day. Now let's say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. Well, in keeping what you've been talking about, as you can imagine, your audience is certainly responding to this whole Obamacare debacle. And Roger from New Jersey sent me an email saying that last week, Daryl Issa, chairman of the House Government Oversight and Reform Committee, along with Jim Jordan, sent the White House a letter requesting testimony from top Obama aides Nancy Ann DeParlay and Jeannie Lambrew, both a leading figure shaping the White House position in Obamacare design and implementation. Issa wanted them to appear at the November 20th hearing on the so far disastrous rollout of the president's national health care scheme. So on Tuesday, she got her answer. The answer is no. Neither of those people responded to the chairman's letter, but White House counsel Catherine Ruemmler told Issa she had no business asking the White House about the president's signature achievement. So this is no different than people inquiring about the efficacy of vaccines, in my opinion. I don't believe anyone's going to come forward, but thankfully we have people like you who are putting this factual, scientific-based information out, which no one else is going to reveal.
Well,
they lose too much money.
My problem is that on the left, especially on some popular programs on Pacifica, they promote vaccines. They have been leading cheerleaders for the pharmaceutical industry, and they have gone soft on Obama. They'll hit certain issues, but they won't tell people to withdraw their support from the corporate Democratic Party or the Hillary Clinton campaign, and even Tom Hartman and some of the others, which is unfortunate. And so what we have is we have an overly medicated society. We have a completely failed medical industrial complex. And that is what's important about Obamacare. If you're starting off with the idea that we have the best, most effective, and safest medicine in the world, and you want to get more people to benefit from it, I could understand that, and I would support that. But we have the worst, most deadly medical industrial complex. We fail miserably. We have no good science, not just in vaccines, but in pain management, in cardiovascular with statins, in psychiatry, mental health with all the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors.
Cancer.
In cancer with chemotherapy. So when you look at what drives our medical industrial complex, hence our health care delivery system, it is commodifying people so that they can become a part of the very profitable insurance, pharmaceutical, medical industrial complex. And that's what Obamacare does. It turns people as commodities over to the insurance and pharmaceutical industry. Until you have that argument, till you allow people in for that debate, then the whole point of whether the system works or doesn't work, can get on or can't get on, have enrolled or not enrolled, it becomes secondarily unimportant. That would be like asking people who are angry because they didn't have a chance to get their Kool-Aid without asking, am I going to be with Jim Jones if I drink this Kool-Aid? Well, Obamacare is the Jim Jones Kool-Aid test.
Yeah.
So thank you, Luann.
Okay.
Let's say hello to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Today I'm talking about the zero-sum mindset and public policy, the notion that in order for somebody to gain, somebody has got to lose.
Okay. We'll go to Retrieve Lead right now. Please stay with us.